Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. The Scott Peterson case was argued yesterday, and we had a very interesting program devoted to the whole phenomenon of the mega case and how it's forever changed the justice system. Current events overtook us, and that program will air at a future date. Just as we were recovering from a pandemic and slowly inching our way out from various shelter-in-place orders and towards a more normal existence, events once again overtook us. Another police killing, this one in Minnesota, all caught on camera, and that it plays out in slow motion only seems to make matters worse. As all this plays out and people are left to try to make some sense out of a senseless tragedy, we all share in the losses suffered by the friends and family of George Lloyd. And some see themselves called to action to redress grievances against their government in a series of protests that span the entire country. With destruction of a magnitude that hasn't been seen here in quite some time, tonight I'm joined by a distinguished panel to discuss the implications of the. There's much to discuss. As always, we welcome your calls. While we shelter in place, some of us are glued to the news, shocked by what's going on just outside the windows. We seek normalcy, and especially we want to hear from you. If you have questions for my guests, whether you want to understand how law enforcement is looking out for your interest, or to seek advice if you've been charged, or want to talk about how we got here or the significance of the protest and whether it can or should lead to change. We know some of you are outraged or upset by what occurred last week, others perhaps more so by what's happening in the week since. But please feel free to call us, and when you do give us a call, remember, this has affected all of us. But please try to keep your calls civil and not personal. Our phone number right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, the protest, First Amendment law, criminal law, or any questions relating to race or civil disobedience or the justice system. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And as always, we're happy to discuss all your questions, but stop short of giving precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case. However, I'm more than happy to pass along the legal principles that can help guide your decision-making. And with that, I'd like to introduce our guest, our panel tonight. Joining us tonight, San Mateo attorney Kevin Allen is a former director of the Office of Citizen Complaints of the San Francisco Police Commission. He was a deputy public defender in San Francisco, who for the past 13 years is in private practice in San Mateo, San Francisco, Santa Clara, and Alameda counties, representing people that have been accused of crimes. Oakland-based civil rights attorney John Burris is known for representing Rodney King in a civil rights lawsuit against the Los Angeles Police Department. And since then, Mr. Burris has represented plaintiffs in a number of high-profile lawsuits against police departments across the state, including the Oakland Raiders case, where a gang of Oakland officers were found to be planting evidence on citizens. This has led to the federal government appointing to investigate and oversee the department, and which maintains to this day. Dean Johnson is a practicing attorney. He's also an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on both legal and political matters for entities including ABC News, NBC News, and Al Jazeera. A former prosecutor, Mr. Johnson practices criminal defense and civil litigation in both state and federal courts. Already interning at the San Mateo District Attorney's Office when he graduated from UC Hastings in 1977, San Mateo County District Attorney Steve Wagstaff is a former president of the California District Attorneys Association and a frequent visitor to this broadcast. Steve Wagstaff runs an office that endeavors to achieve justice and make San Mateo County as safe an environment as possible in which to live and work. To all my guests, welcome to Your Legal Rights, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Nice to be here.
Welcome, Jeff. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Good to be with you, as always.
You know, the first question that pops into a lot of people's minds is, you know, looking outside at what's going on in a world that's changed so dramatically and so rapidly, how did we get here? Steve, I know you sit as the prosecutor of San Mateo County, and I know you well enough to know that you would not be doing it if you didn't work in a system that you and I both feel is tries to be fair and colorblind. At least the time that the case gets to us, I don't think anybody is, certainly not knowingly, anything to the contrary. Can you talk a little bit about the system and what things look like when they reach you?
Well, you know, it depends, of course, where you sit in the system as to the attitude you're going to have to it. You know, over the decades I've been involved in it, I've always, and I think my office has tried, and I think any prosecutor of integrity tries to do it the right way and the fair way to make sure that we're as colorblind as we can be. But obviously we're human beings and we try to adjust to that. Twice over the last 2 years, I've had all of my prosecutors go through implicit bias. So I went through it and I realized it's right. And so we try to do it, but it doesn't change because we're human beings. All you can do is try and as consciously as you can. And that means all segments of it. That means the prosecutors, it means defense attorneys, and most importantly, it means judges, because in the end, the judges are the ones that make the decisions. And recognize when some tragedy occurs, like what occurred in this case, which just, it causes all of us to have, in my mind, despair, anger, sadness, from whatever perspective one is in. I mean, I look around at Kevin and John. I've not walked in your shoes. I have never had anybody ever racially profile me. And the anger has got to be even more. Not having had that, I'm still angry at what has occurred. And looking back, how did we get here, like you said, Jeff? And that's sort of where I come from is, okay, after things slow down a little bit, how do we then take steps so it doesn't just become another Missouri? It doesn't just become another Rodney King, which means small progress, but not big change in the system.
Steve, if I could just jump in real quick. I agree with everything you say, but I've got a question for you, and I should tell everyone that Steve was my supervisor when I was a homicide prosecutor. A lot that I learned about prosecuting homicides, I learned from Steve. And I was shocked today to hear that the Attorney General had filed homicide charges against all four of the former police officers that were involved in this horrific incident. But as he filed them, he said, you know, it's going to be hard to get a conviction. And I just ask you, Steve, as one of the best homicide prosecutors I've ever met, I mean, we have this horrific incident on videotape. There are probably 100 videotapes out there. It's in color. The production quality is very high. I mean, is this truly a hard prosecution, or is this a homicide prosecutor's dream case? And by saying that a conviction is going to be difficult, are we seeing the beginning of another Rodney King case or another Messerly case where we're being conditioned to expect that there isn't going to be a conviction?
Dean, that's a great question, because I sat there, I watched on the news tonight the Attorney General give his statement, because I've been wondering, is Minnesota law different than California's? How would you achieve it? As to the primary officer, the one with the knee on the neck for so many minutes, you're right. I think that just looks like a dream prosecution where a prosecutor can truly, with emotion, demand justice in that case. As to the other three, I'm fascinated to know what Minnesota law is. I read their homicide statute, and I know for two of the officers, they were compressing and holding him down on the chest. That must be the theory and how they're going to get those two. There was another one who was standing by. I said in a call I was on last night that, you know, it might be time that we impose on certain segments of society, law enforcement officers, a duty to not just stand by when something's occurring. As a parent, with my children, as a parent, if they do something that is, I have a duty to protect them, to step in to protect them. Under California law, that's not true criminally of law enforcement officers. It does take an action. So my thought is, I'm not sure why. Again, I don't have Minnesota juries. I have San Francisco Bay Area juries. But I know here in the Bay Area, it's tough to convict officers. People don't want to convict officers. But I look at that video, as you say, and I say, boy, it does seem to me a case that I would love myself to prosecute.
You know, you made reference to unconscious bias. And one of the things that came to mind when you mentioned judges, we had an African-American attorney who in San Mateo County, fairly new at the time to the county, very well experienced attorney, steps up in court to have his case called, asks the court to please call and states the name of the case. And a judge who was generally very level-headed and very well-regarded, I don't believe harbored any prejudices. He looked directly at him and stated, well, wait a minute, are you the defendant? And that judge has since retired, and that attorney himself is now a judge. But that's an example to me about unconscious bias, things that we may not be aware of, the expectations that have been created, and it hits us at all levels. Kevin, Alan, let me turn to you for a minute. Well, actually, I'll open this up to all the attorneys, but I think, Kevin, you might want to speak first. But talk to us a little bit about unconscious bias and how we could flesh that out. I mean, at some point, in some case, you have to address the conclusions that were formed before you got there by police or the like. You may have to flesh this out in picking a jury. How does this stuff hit you? What can you do about it?
Hey, Jeff. Well, thank you. Can you guys hear me?
Fine. You come.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for having everybody. Good to see you. So I wanted to real briefly go back to the comments that were just made and the officers and the charging. That has been a question asked to me over the past 2 days. How come they're not charging all of the officers? What do you think? And I agree with Steve. I hear Dean's point. The number one officer with the knee on the neck, I think is definitely a person who they needed to charge. I am glad that they did, you know, with a little bit more urgency than they have in other cases, because I think that shows society that folks are taking this seriously. If it would have been 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks before that occurred, I think that's one of the issues that we face is people feel that the actions are slow in situations like this. If it's an individual shooting somebody in a local neighborhood, there are charges levied frequently and often. And so here, having them bring the charge was good. The other three, I think they really had to look at it, because what you don't want to do, in my opinion, is overwhelming the jury and the system. If you put everybody out there and people have a hard time convicting one, there is a possibility that they will let them all off. And I think in the Rodney King, that was one of the things that occurred. And I don't know, John, you can speak more to that. But sometimes if you have one person who seems more culpable, juries may feel, well, I don't want to hurt all of them. And maybe it was in policy, or maybe it was okay, and they will release them all. So I think it took some time to determine whether or not they had the case. Dean, to what you said, there was a video of an individual, I don't know if you all saw it, an officer had another person on the ground during a protest with a knee on the neck. And there was an officer next to him. And the officer next to him, after about 20 seconds, pulled the knee of the first officer off. I don't know if it was because there were cameras. I don't know if it's because that person realized, hey, this guy can't breathe. But that's what we need to instill more in officers and our law enforcement and everybody. We all need to speak up. Jeff, to implicit bias, I'll keep it short. I've done the MC Lee for this several years now. It's such a broad topic. It's hard to discuss, but it really goes to just years and years of attitude and feelings within our country and our community. It's hard, I think, for us to turn it around overnight, but it's something that first and foremost, it's information. It's making people realize that there are biases. When I talk to juries, oftentimes, when I was younger, I used to ask people right then, I'd say, raise your hand if you have bias against Black people. Well, of course, no one's going to raise their hand because I'm standing in front of them and they would be admitting a bias if they had it and everyone was uncomfortable. But then I would couch questions as, if you saw a young man sitting on the curb by a police car, what do you think? What's your first thought? And as people would answer, and they might say, I wonder what he did. You know, of course, why did he have to do something? Oh, I understand. Yes. And if it was a white versus a Black male, or if it was a female. And so it's an education. It's fleshing out the biases first. We all have them, Jeff. Every one of us has some type of bias inside of us. And it's recognizing those biases first and foremost, and then addressing them. But it's something that needs to be done in a large system-wide basis. We can't do this individually. We have to attack this in the departments, in the courts, in the legislature. We have to address this as a society.
Kevin, you worked with the San Francisco police for a very long time. We're hearing all of the old arguments now about the police, the one rotten apple spoils the barrel argument, and we're hearing the argument, oh, this is a culture of police departments. In your experience, which is it? I mean, is there a culture of racism, or is it just a case of a very, very few officers who create the problems and create a bad image for all police officers?
I'm gonna let John answer the bulk of this because this is really his department. But what I have seen, what I saw, Dean, were people often made mistakes. What I learned from at least my experience, my 4 years, 3 years at the OCC, most people wanted to do a good job. Most people wanted to go out there and protect and serve. I think that a few people, and this was very, it became very apparent in that text scandal that came out, people, the texting, the language that was used. Again, it's our, when we are complacent in our behavior, our intervention, if somebody makes a black joke over text and I don't say something or other people don't say anything, then we are promoting that behavior. Now, the person who doesn't say anything may not be racist, but if you don't say anything, you're not assisting, you're not helping. So I think there are probably a few people who have problems, who have issues, but on a larger scale, most people are just going to sit back, and it's that diffusion of responsibility. Somebody else will handle it, not my responsibility.
Let me join in here. First off, can anyone hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I've had the experience on the police issue in terms of criminal cases in ways that's very troubling to me. First off, I was involved in the Rodney King case, and I was involved in the Measurely case. Each of those cases, there was tremendous, tremendous reluctance to prosecute police officers. And I'll tell you, in the Rodney King case, which was even I had some empathy for one of the officers, because there were four officers who were doing this beating, but one officer was directing. And all four of those officers did not really want to involve themselves on the same level, but they all got charged. And, you know, and that made it more difficult for all of them. And certainly it was hard for the jury to decipher, but you could lose. And I think the you can lose some of that by having too many charges that a jury has to work through. Particularly in related to the police. In the Measurely case, look, it was a straight up case. It looked like murder from my point of view. I'm on this case. I know what the person has said at the outset, that he thought he had a gun. But ultimately, when the jury came, the jury did not want to believe that this person had deliberately shot and killed this man with the intent to do it, and therefore was willing to accept his argument or his position that maybe he had pulled out the wrong weapon. And therefore, that justified. The jury was more than happy to accept that. And as I look at the case here, I just finished doing an interview down in L.A. on this very question. And I was asked the question, do you see any way that any of these guys can be found not guilty? And the question is, yes, I can see that. And I think that we all agree that the number one guy, he can go down very easily. I don't see the only thing that happened to him, he can get a lesser included offense. But he's right. Going down on first, on second, or third. The other three or four, other three guys, that's a different challenge because they really are a function of what somebody else had decided. And they would then do their own individual role based upon what the boss man had already decided. It would be difficult for a jury to decipher through whether or not they had individual intent, particularly when one person says, let's turn him over. I think that person can't breathe. Well, a jury is going to say, yeah, he had an idea, but he was told to do it. The lead person says, no, leave him right where he is. So I guess on balance, it's very, very tough. And even in a case that's so clearly as this, that you're going to convict all four of these people, Although I think all four should be charged. I don't think that they all should have been charged with murder, but certainly they should have been charged. I think if you charge it too high, you have a problem with this not happening, convicting. So that's my general feeling about police. And I've been involved in countless cases, and I think Steve knows this. Many cases I think should be prosecuted. But I know that the DA doesn't have will not do it. But I think that, and that's another kind of problem. When we talk about reform, I do reform not on a national basis. I view it as a local basis. If you want to change what's going on, people have to protest, and they have to vote. They have to change the dynamics of those people there, so there's a price to pay, and they have to be made uncomfortable. If you don't do that, this is just going to be another Occupy moment. And when I say that, we yelled and screamed and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then 10 months from now, everyone goes back to doing what they're doing, unless there is a group of people. And I think we did this in Steve's case, where some people stayed focused and tried to work through a change. Well, that's what you have to do. That's what lawyers are supposed to do. That's what we try to do and whenever we can. But you need a group of community people to work with you. And if the community people are not with you, because they're the ones that put the real pressure on the political people. And if you don't have the pressure on the political people, you will not get change. I was just in a press conference today where a new police chief and a new public person were making comments. They happened to get there as a result of the pressure that's been put on them by the community. And that has brought about some change and is ultimately going to bring about some reforms. But it can happen. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about unconscious bias and biases, because in my mind, I think Kevin says it, people have their biases. What you have to do is figure out how to work through the individual case that you have to minimize it and neutralize it. That's lawyer work. That's also jury selection work. How do you get through it? And all of which we have to do. And so I don't want to spend a lot of time worrying about that. Now, I will say, how do we get here? Because I think this is the more important thing. How do we get here is not just happened yesterday. This is years and years and years. And what you have is in these communities, and many of the ones I'm involved in, you have so much police bias activity taking place, and uncontrolled, unmitigated, and no way to respond to. And people have, like, exploded in these communities. Now, the white community didn't explode because of what's taken place hundreds of years. They don't know that. They exploded because they saw what happened on that video. When you see that video and you see a man is being crushed and died in front of you, your own humanity, whoever you are, will come forward. And so I don't think we should think too much about this as a singularly important moment about reform. A singularly important moment in terms of the explosion and the eruption that people have when they see something really bad. But the real question is, what do you do about this now? And that's where you're going to take the community support. That's where the protesters and people have to come together and then try to work with the local communities they're in to bring about the reform. That's a challenge. And that's how I see where we are right now, that where we have to go.
You know, one of our biases is that we always want to believe that we're being led, we're being protected, we're being taken care of by leaders that are doing the best that can be done for us. We always want to have faith in our leaders and the like at a time of crisis. And that's a bias that many people carry with them, but not everyone. I'll let you finish up the issue of bias, but then I'm going to want to shift gears a little bit.
Right. And I only wanted to say, and thank you, John, for your words. I think, I know we're talking about one particular case with the implicit bias, but one thing that I really think we need to focus on is the biases that people have. There's a huge problem, John, and you're aware of this, with the police interacting with the neighborhoods and the population, the black population or various minority populations. And I think that is based a lot on this implicit bias that we have to change. People go into situations with this bias that they may not even be aware of. And it goes both sides. We want to feel protected by the police. And there's so many young kids in the neighborhood who feel the police aren't there to protect them. And I'm not of that feel. I tell people, if there's something wrong, call the police. You need to call the police. But on the flip side, somebody going into a situation seeing a young African-American child who's almost my size, 13 years old, though, they're not seeing a 13-year-old or a 12-year-old. They're seeing a scary individual. And it's that bias that once we can start to change that, we can start to change this, our society, the views in our society. That's just my opinion.
Not many people see one of somebody with my looks walking down the street and look over and run and say, oh my God, there's an accountant over there. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing the state of unrest, how we got here, where it may be leading. Joining me tonight are San Mateo County District Attorney Steve Wagstaff, Civil Rights Attorney John Burris, former Director of the Office of Citizens Complaint, Attorney Kevin Allen, and Emmy Award-nominated legal analyst and political analyst Dean Johnson. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question that you have about what's going on right now. Criminal law, First Amendment law, where those two run together. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. And let me shift gears a little bit from how we got here to where we are at this moment. Dean Johnson, how is this protest movement similar to other movements we've had in the past, and how is it different? I mean, it seems like we've had riots in Watts. We had the Rodney King beating, things that really triggered a lot of activism and a lot of unrest throughout the country, and yet much of it passed on. How is this different?
Well, you know, I remember some years ago marching in an anti-Vietnam War march, and I met this old communist activist who was about the same age then as I am now, and we were talking about how great the 60s were. And this gentleman said to me, oh, the 60s? The 60s are nothing. You should have been around in the 30s. I mean, that was a demonstration. That was a protest. I wish that having reached this age, I could turn to the young people who are right now just getting their first real civics lesson at the end of a baton or a rubber bullet and say, you think this is something, you should have been around in the 60s. But I can't say that because this protest movement is qualitatively different from the Vietnam movement, from the civil rights movement. This is, in fact, I think, and I'm putting on my political analyst hat here, this is the first protest movement that we've had within the United States. It's truly a modern protest movement. It has more to do with, it has more in common with things like Arab Spring and the resistance in Hong Kong than it does with the resistance in the 60s. And the difference is that the means of communication are very different now. The internet is a tool that can be used to organize mass movements in a matter of seconds. It's also a tool that can be used to monitor the people who organize mass movements. The images on the internet, as Kevin alluded to earlier, are the things that really spark these movements. The iconic image of, say, in Tunisia when the Arab Spring began, of Mohammed Bouazizi self-immolating in frustration over the corruption of that regime. And of course, we have the graphic image here of this officer with his knee on the neck of an African-American man who died. Those are the fuses that light the spark that releases all of the frustration and all the anger. Those movements are, this kind of movement is enormously powerful. It's something that is a threat to the power structure. It's something that can make real change. Even those old-fashioned movements like the Vietnam War movement actually brought down two presidents. Movements like Arab Spring actually brought down two dictators. So this is something that can seriously change the structure of society. With a big if, and John Burris alluded to this, when I teach politics, I talk to my students about a thing called the catharsis of denunciation. There's an effect in a protest movement where people can go out and they can raise their fist in the air and they can denounce the status quo and they can do all of that. And then they simply walk away. The question is, how long does that protest movement stick? Does it produce the kind of people who will see it through and who will see concrete change and make sure that concrete change happens? That we have yet to decide. Will communications, like the means of communication, like the internet, will they be a force for a democracy, or will they ultimately be a force for controlling these kinds of protest movements? Will fake news dominate over those iconic images and so on? You know, those are questions that are being raised now, and we don't know the answers just yet.
You know, Dean,
the moment you're listening to KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616. That number again, 415-989-1616. Or visit sfbar.org for more information. If you'd like to participate in tonight's show, call 415-841-4134. Now back to Jeff Hayden and his guests for your legal rights.
Jeff, I wanted to follow up just a little bit on what Dean says.
We've got callers lined up as well, but I wanted to turn to you first, John.
Yeah, I want to just follow up a little bit on what Dean, because what Dean is saying in an expansive way is so really, really true. If we didn't have such tremendous baggage already. Because I'm going to tell you that part of what has happened in the African-American community here has really been an explosion with a real sense of history. And that history goes back to, you know other times where there's been riots and beatings and, you know, the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, when the military people came home and got 65, 68, all of this is deep-seated. Certainly in my soul is there, because I know what my father and them had to tell me about what happened, and my grandfather and before them. So part of what the African-American community is dealing with the police issue is this real sense of history of nothing has been done in the past, and this is an opportunity to explode on it. That's not the result. It's not the resolution. It just means I understand where it's coming from. And then you have the white community as well, who also explode because they see the inhumanity of what happened to Mr. Floyd. But as you said, and I agree, okay, I got it. So now where do we go from here? And do we have enough people here in the modern day technology, in modern day communications, and the modern, and even the philosophy to go forward and say, I'm gonna really work to change this in some way, and willing to participate. I don't really know if there'll be substantial people to do that, but I also know this. The masses are not going to ultimately make the changes. It's gonna be a people who understand the feeling of the masses, who will then participate in a smaller group and making those changes. As W.B. Du Bois would said, it's the talented 10th who has the responsibility to take care of the other 90%. And that's what I see happened from these kind of efforts, and that's kind of our individual responsibility.
Let me turn it over to George in Oakland. George, welcome to your legal rights.
Hello.
Hi, George. Hello. You're on the.
Yeah, you want me to speak or what?
Yes,
you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, listen. Let's cut to the chase and let's stop this petty thing. Let's look at it like it is. For the last 100 years, ever since just the 100-year anniversary, America, which practices white supremacy, failed to pass an anti-lynch law 100 years ago. If you want to root out white supremacy, the first thing you have to do in this country is pass a lynch law. That's Zimmerman, that's those policemen, that's anybody who lynches someone on a public street as a federal crime, takes murder one. So let's stop all this pettiness. And then the guys from San Mateo, you're pointing the finger at Minneapolis. It's like the pot calling the kettle black. What did you do about Chinedu Oboki, the cops that tased him to death? Let's get down to it, fellas. I'm this way. I'm Vietnam. And I'll tell you, I don't think America's got the heart to face itself. White America will never pass an anti-lynch law. Okay? It's in all of you. All of you. I don't give a damn what you say until we pass a law and start prosecuting lynchers in federal court, putting them in prison, executing them, whatever it is. That's what it's going to take, okay? It's not going to take some of this stuff you guys are talking about, police, this and that. No, you lynch somebody, you're dead. If you're wearing a uniform, it don't matter. Lynching is lynching. That's death, okay? Thank you.
All right.
George, thank you for joining us for Legal Rights. I'm going to ask future callers to try not to make it personal. But before I turn to our next caller, I want to give Steve Wagstaff a chance to respond to that. George brought up lynching, and I think where he was going in large part was the stand your ground laws that are prevalent in some states, certainly not all states. How does that differ from California, and what do we have to protect people from the private actor?
Tough question, Jeff, because the answer is only the protection one can get from, I think, law enforcement. I'll give you the example. Last night, Redwood City had a very peaceful demonstration. However, there was a when they started to march down one of our streets toward a gas station, the police had a report that there was a guy in the gas station emptying multiple firearms out of his truck. They quickly went there. What they found, it was the station owner. And he was preparing in case somebody came to do that, to go damage his property. As long as that attitude is permitted, as long as people think that's okay, well, then we're in trouble. We're in difficulty trying to overcome that. Fortunately, they took his guns from him, told him no, and held the marchers up for about 10 minutes while they cleared that, and that took care of it. For what was otherwise a very peaceful, there was only one arrest made the entire night with thousands of people involved. That's the trouble. And I understand exactly what he's talking about in every case. There was, as to Mr. Okobe, there was a narrative out there, and I understand it. I don't try to change it. I know what the decision that I made and why, but it still boils down to law enforcement, everybody. I don't just say it's, I agree with what John is saying. If you don't have everybody change, it won't matter. It will not change, because I've watched it too many times. As I said at the beginning, I've seen too many incidents. And as John said, after a number of months, does it just fade away into history? Does it just get forgotten? You know, I heard legislators today, I heard our congresswoman today saying, we need to go to Congress and change. It takes the follow-up, it takes a resolution to do it, and not just let it fall off. If it falls off, then this event will have a conviction, it will be whatever it is going to be, but it won't change the core values of the country. And that's the part, I don't know, hope is hard for me. I said this last night to some ministers I was speaking. Hope is hard for me because I've just seen it fall off the deck. I want what John and Kevin said, Dean mentioned, I want it to happen. I want to be part of making it happen with whatever authority I have. Mm-hmm. But it takes the whole community, I agree.
Yeah, and what's got to come out of this is some fundamental institutional change. As someone who's trained in the social sciences, you know, I know a little bit of the history of this. It was 1963, 57 years ago, when Martin Luther King made his I Have a Dream speech. Are we less divided now than we were then? I would say that we're more divided, and there are good reasons why that's the case. In 1972, there was a book published called The Emerging Republican Majority. And it laid out a strategy for national politics that was explicitly racist. It played upon dividing the country, one ethnic group against another, one religious group against another. It had chapters on how to deal with Southern Democrats, and you can imagine what that said. It had chapters on how to deal with Jewish voters and so on. That's been a strategy for the last some 40 years. On the left side of the political spectrum, there's been a similar strategy in terms of identity politics. Politicians have sought to stay in power by dividing us, by telling us that society is a zero-sum game, that when we give to one, we're taking away from everyone else, and so on. That attitude, that framing of politics doesn't exist in other societies. And in many ways, those societies are more peaceful, more harmonious, and we're happy. But we need to look into things like the way social media divides us through fake news and through creating divisions and the silo effect that lets people just look at the kinds of things that they want to hear and that they're interested in. Those basic institutional changes have to be addressed. Otherwise, we're going to become more and more divided, not less and less divided.
Let me turn it to caller Amanda in San Mateo. Amanda, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Okay.
Amanda, can you hear me? You're on the air. Okay,
good
we'll
evening.
Pass.
I'm here. Good evening, Jeff. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's good to hear from you.
Yes, I just want to call in and say that I am so proud of the Bay Area community for pulling together and peacefully demonstrating for the rights of all people of color in our communities. And I've, as you know, Jeff, protested in for the last, I took a break today, but before that, for the last 4 days in various counties in this area. And San Francisco, the police took a very low profile and did not take a militant stand. And in response, there were peaceful demonstrations, at least at the one that I was at on Saturday. On Sunday, I had the opposite experience where in San Jose, the police took an extremely militant stand. They kept encroaching upon the crowd, and in response, the crowd became aggravated, and it resulted in rubber bullets being fired, really for no reason at the crowd. So my experience has been that the... Sorry, Jeff.
Oh, I was just saying we've seen some imagery of that on television where we had one officer who was rather belligerent toward the crowd and seemed to be taunting people as he was then firing projectiles.
Yeah.
And those are exactly the type of police that need to be weeded out. There really needs to be a change in how police are screened and hired. There needs to be psychological testing, and there needs to be a better job of weeding out the bad seeds.
Well, thank you for joining us, and those are valuable insights. Before I let you go, did anybody else want to comment on what Amanda had just offered before I move on to the next caller?
I think that Amanda's comments has some validity, but I will tell you that we spent a lot of time in Oakland trying to weed out bad seeds, and it hasn't happened. That we still have numbers of officers who engage in misconduct, not as much as they used to be, but the question is, how do you get to those issues early enough and then hold people accountable? To some extent, the culture of a department can prevent some of these things from happening. If there's an old boys, quote, neighborhood and nepotism that exists within a department, people who commit offenses and not held accountable because, you know, they've been adopted by a group. The tradition within a department really is a difficult thing to get by. And just like we saw that man standing by and didn't do anything and didn't intervene because the culture of the department says that's okay because we're looking out for you. And that's the biggest problem, as I see, you know, one of the big problems in trying to change the culture of the department. And that's not just screening at the outset. I mean, certainly there's there. But it's the culture of a department is the controlling mechanism on how that department is going to run and how people are going to treat other people, either other employees or the community.
I agree with everything that John has to say. I would just point out that one of the phenomena we have of this era of protest movements is people on the other side of the line, people who are agents of the government and the status quo, crossing that line. And that's a sign of very, very deep divisions in a society, and a sign that the recognition of those divisions and the recognition of those problems cuts across many, many lines, including the police.
So, Dean, one point. Kevin Phillips is the name who was the big architect of the Republican program back in the 1970s. Kevin Phillips.
Let me turn it over to another caller. I'm going to ask everybody on the panel to keep comments really tight because we have a couple callers left, okay. And we're very close to time. I'm going to give each of you some time to sum up, but so we have to keep it a little tight. But let me turn it to Warren in Oakland. You're on your legal rights.
Oh, hi. Thank you. This is Warren. I marched on Monday, and I think you've answered some of my questions, but you just kind of wonder, if I see I'm a white man, if I see some cop, some policeman on a black man's neck, what can I do? I don't think I think it's a crime. It would be a crime for me to try and interfere with the police. But I'm just wondering what else. I mean, I guess that's a real question we're all saying. Do we, keep marching, run for office, try to educate, donate? I guess that's something we're all struggling with. And I'm a teacher, so that came up today. What do we teach our children about this?
Would anyone disagree?
Yes. The quick answer to that would be yes, do all of the above, and for God's sakes, teach your children about what it means to be in a democracy and what it means to protest.
But I mean, as a citizen, I don't think I have that right to interfere with an arrest, right?
You don't.
No, no, I don't. So, I mean, right.
The district attorney is shaking his head. Yes, you do not have a right to interfere with the.
You can be close by and you can film. You just can't interfere, but you can be close by. You can record what you see and make some notes in of it and then take it to the proper authorities, internal affairs, or some lawyer groups that are dealing with these issues. But you cannot interfere with the police.
Yeah.
You
have to stand the anniversary of Tenement is tomorrow. I don't want to be a tank man. Stand in front of the tanks. That's kind of be a hero.
Want that.
Running low on time, I do want to get to the last couple of callers. David in Oakland, welcome to your legal rights.
Good evening. And I have so appreciated this show. And I appreciate every one of you and your input. I just have a couple of points, maybe questions. The first of which is, could we try all four separately rather than lumping them together so that it wouldn't be one of these situations where if somebody decides, okay, this one's not, but this one is, it's not going to jeopardize the whole process? That's my first question. The second one is about policing. Back in the day, I'm an older person. Back in the day, there were beat cops, folks that just walked the neighborhoods. They just were not in cruisers. They were not needing all of this other piece, and they were connecting with the community. And I'm offering that as a possible solution to resolving some of these conflicts, perhaps, don't know, just suggesting. Thank you for taking my call.
Before any of our panelists answer David's question, let me first remind everyone listening that everyone on our panel practices in California. We're all attorneys practicing under California law. And when you ask a legal question, sometimes it can vary in other states. But with that, anybody have an answer for George?
Well, I do
think
Dean.
Go ahead, Steve.
Go ahead, John. You're talking.
Now, I would say I think it's a major question that has to be dealt with in terms of from the prosecution point of view. Do you try all four together or do you try them individually? I think if you try them individually and you try the weaker ones first, you're going to lose those cases. I think you got to try the big case first and maybe have as many of them in that case as you can. But I think if you stretch it out and you go individually, I think that the three people on the end will be very difficult cases to get convictions. I think you got to try them all together if you can. And you may lose one or two, but you're going to lose most of them, the other three, if in fact you try them separately, from my point of view.
And I share the view as to trying them. My first reaction, John, was I would want to try the bad guy, the guy with the knee in the neck. I want him because I'm going to get him.
Yeah, right.
The other three, I don't want a jury to throw them out. And by convicting the big guy. So I was sort of thinking, I want to try those other three together because, with a different viewpoint where that jury will feel a responsibility to convict them if they deserve it. That was my reaction.
Well, that's three together. But what about one? That's the difference.
I don't like that. Then you end up like the Johnny Gray case back in Baltimore, where they all get.
I don't like it either. That's my point. I don't like it.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But I like the three at one time. Yeah.
We have one last caller. We have only about a minute left. Let me turn to the star child in San Francisco. You're on your little lights.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. Yes, I'm the chair of the Libertarian Party here in San Francisco, and we very much stand in solidarity with all the victims of police violence and abuse, including most lately and tragically George Floyd. We need radical reform in this country, and the Democrats and Republicans are not giving it to us. The Democrats have been in power in most of the big cities in the United States for decades, and they have failed to seriously address this problem of police abuse. And I'm sorry to say, when we addressed Steve Wagstaff and San Mateo County is a good example of this. There's a 2018 incident here. I'm looking at the article right now where he failed to charge four officers who were involved in the death of a 55-year-old man, Ramzi Saad, who became unresponsive following a struggle with officers. He was shot with a taser multiple times outside his home in Redwood City. You know, the DAs are generally too close to the police. You know, they cooperate in having a separate standard of justice for police officers and people in the criminal justice system. They're not held to the same standards as the public, let alone higher standards, which they should be, since they've been professionally trained and they're being paid good money. People like Wagstaff need to be voted out. We need real reform, not these cosmetic changes.
Topic we can have for a future show, but I've premised this entire show and said this multiple times. I don't want the callers to take it personally or to make personal attacks on the people on the panel, no matter which side they're on. These are issues that are important to all of us. We've all felt affected by things that are going on in the last week on both sides, but let's not make it personal and make personal attacks. Thank you for joining us. You and I can have a conversation later. I welcome you to a future show, but this is not the conversation that we're here to have tonight. Thank you. We really are running low on time, and I have promised to give each of you somewhere between a minute to a minute and a half, but unfortunately we don't have longer for any closing remarks you want to make. Steve Wagstaff, why don't I start with you?
Tragic times, horrible thing occurred. Will good come out of it? That's what we've been talking about tonight. Are we going to make good come out of it? I hope so. I pray so. But it's only going to be done if we go to work and we don't forget and fall back. I wish there were more John Burrises and Kevin Allens in the world who could help carry that ball. And who could tell me what I can do, because I haven't felt over the years I have. So my goal is, I hope we can do something to change.
Who would like to go next? A minute, minute and a half?
You know, I'm an optimist. Given all the work that I'm involved in, I still believe that there's real possibilities of moving the social agenda positively. And I say that because of a historical point of view. That has always been the case. There's always been lawyers who've been socially conscious, who've tackled the difficult issues, have moved the social agenda. And we are just at a stage where we've accepted the baton that they've given. And at some point, we're going to pass it on. So it will not be dealt with completely in our lifetime, but neither was it in our ancestors' and family members' lifetime. It's a continuing effort, as they say, moving toward a more perfect union. And we're part of that process.
Kevin Allen, any last thoughts?
Yeah, and I'm going to try something in 45 seconds to do this. You know, I listened to everybody. I listened to George. I heard George's frustration on the phone. And that frustration, I think, is important. I listened to Warren when he talked about he didn't want to be Tank Man in Tiananmen Square. Steve said something earlier about, you know, we want this to continue. John mentioned how this has been so deep-rooted with our ancestors. And Dean was talking about what makes this protest different. What's going on? I'll tell you, I want to first preface by saying I'm never one to advocate violence. I'm never one to advocate, you know, destruction or property or whatnot. Here, I think what's going to make this different is you can sense a level of frustration. And there's been frustration in other protests. But since even the last mass protest, there's a problem. We've had, whether you knelt or not during the national anthem, people told us it's not this time. Don't do it now. People have said, don't do it at the Oscars. We don't want to hear it. Unfortunately, after they told us that, now we're here again. We're here again. So people are frustrated. And what we need is to keep this conversation going, not just after somebody gets shot and killed, but we need this in 6 months. We need this in 12 months. We need this in 2 years. We need to keep this conversation going. Minute and 15 seconds. Sorry, folks. That's what I want to say.
You did good. Dean Johnson, I'm going to throw one thing out there and turn it to you to for any last comments. But
okay,
listening to this show and listening to people talk about what can be done nationally, what can be done locally, what can be done in the law, what people's entire thought process changing, I hearken back to a course I took in college from Andy Barlow. Andy, if you're out there listening, I know you, last I had heard you're in Berkeley, I hope you're well. And the entire premise of this course of law and social change is that the law doesn't social change, nor can it. It follows the social change, and that's all it, the best it can do. Dean Johnson, take 1 to 2 minutes to, for any closing thoughts.
Well, you know, the philosopher Hannah Arendt said you find political power lying in the streets. And that's, I think, true more than ever today. We have a protest movement here that was sparked by something that was outrageous, that was horrific. We have a response by a government of very limited competence that I think has been in some ways even more outrageous. But if there's anything good that's going to come out of this, is that people are going to go out into the streets, they're going to protest peacefully, and they're going to learn what civil activism is all about. And some of those people will be the people who will make the institutional changes that we need. I know that's true because 40 years ago, I was out there in those streets. And if I hadn't been, I wouldn't be sitting here as a defense attorney today.
And that'll be the last words on the topic. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been talking about our current state of events, about civil unrest. My guests tonight have been San Mateo County District Attorney Steve Wagstaff, Emmy-nominated legal and political commentator Dean Johnson, Oakland civil rights attorney John Burris, and a former director of the Office of Citizen Complaints, Kevin Allen of San Mateo. Your Legal Rights will be back next week. Our long-awaited look at the Scott Peterson case and just how such a high-profile case not only affect that case, but what it means for justice long after the media has moved on. That'll be coming sometime soon, very possibly next week. To each of my guests, I'd like to thank you for joining us. And I'd like to thank all of you for listening. To all of you and at the controls, David Latulippe, I'm Jeff Hayden. Thank you, be safe, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616, or visit sfbar.org for more information.